Nothing here now but the recordings may not be full vision in setting port.
Okay. 3, 2, 1. Hi, this is Candy Minks in Chicago for the agency.
And Eugene Napic in Hanoi, Vietnam.
Right. Boy, we really went international this time.
Yes, I'm sitting at a sidewalk cafe about a block from my hotel at the west edge of the old quarter near the train street.
Great. Now, are you facing your phone straight on?
Well, I have my earphones on, and it has a mic. So there's a mic right by my mouth.
Okay, perfect, perfect. Because it did, I had the impression you were doing this, like moving your body away. That's all good. That's all good.
So I was up very early this morning.
Were you?
Well, twice. Just like when I was here with Sheila 2 years ago, I got up at 3 a.m. We got up at 3 a.m. almost every night. We're 12 hours time difference. It's about 9:30 in the morning here. And it really messes with your rhythm. So you get up at 3 in the morning. I dozed off again. I got up at 6. It was drizzling rain, and I went out for a walk.
Oh. At 3 in the morning?
No, at 6 in the morning when
I got
up. 6
in the morning. 6:30. Okay. Oh, what time is it now? What time is it your time now? Sunday.
It's about 9:30.
On Sunday morning.
Whatever day it is.
All right.
If it's Saturday for you, it's Sunday for me. Yes, it's Sunday.
And again, time is an illusion.
It is, you know, when you take a 15-hour flight to Taipei, a 3-hour layover, and another 3-hour flight to Hanoi, time does get weird.
Whatever you're doing is perfect. Hold on. Whatever you're doing, when you're speaking like that, that was perfect.
Okay. I'll continue to
That's
try
it.
Not
That's
moving.
That's it. Right there. Perfect.
Okay, I won't move except to access my mango smoothie. So I went this morning for a walk, seeking out breakfast, and I found this lady who had a little corner stall with an awning to protect from the rain, two little tables, and the little blue low stools they have here, and she had a sign that said soy, which is what I was looking for. Soy is sticky rice.
Mm.
So she served me up some sticky rice and then dipped down into a cauldron and pulled up a big chunk of braised pork belly and looked at me, and I nodded.
Wow.
So she added that on, and then she pulled up something else that looked like a brown egg, and I nodded. And mm-hmm. turned out to be what I think was a deep-fried egg that was then dropped into this cauldron of braising liquid. And then she scooped on some sauce and served that up with a bowl of slightly pickled cucumbers and some chilies and, of course, the bottle of hot sauce. Everything has the bottle of hot sauce.
Right.
If this is Hanoi comfort food. It's yummy and filling and... it's just so good.
Sounds great. Okay, you said you were going to the History or Museum of Literature today?
Yes, I'm going to go to the Temple of Literature.
Oh, Temple of Literature, yep.
Yeah, it's about a 15-minute walk from here. It was built in 1070, and it was mm-hmm. Vietnam's first university.
Wow.
Dedicated to Confucius, and it's there to identify and promote the nation's most talented scholars. And originally there was a competition in home villages with final exams with people competing against one another in Hanoi. And only a handful of students would pass, and the successful candidates were given gigs by the king. So I'm going to wander out there. I'm hoping the rain will completely curtail, and I'll have a nice walk. I'd like to do some drawing there if it's dry enough.
Okay. Okay. So now tell me about the weather and tell me about some other food and what's the vibe there? What does it look like? What do you, is it hot?
Well, today it's probably about 18 Celsius.
Okay.
You know, below room temperature. I have my leather jacket on. yesterday was a little bit warmer until evening, and it cooled down in the evening. Yesterday and today, it's rained in the morning, but reasonably nice to walk around in.
Okay. What else have you eaten?
Last evening.
Oh, yeah.
Last evening, I walked to a place that's known as Barbecue Chicken Street.
I love it.
It's out of the old quarter, and it's about a 20-25 minute walk from my hotel, and it's a destination. You either know it's there or you don't. You never just find it, but okay. You know when you found the alley that is Chicken Street, you know you're there because you can smell barbecue smoke big time.
Nice.
And there's four or five vendors there, and they each have these giant barbecues set up, and they're barbecuing up chicken, which they skewer chicken wings and chicken legs and chicken feet on bamboo skewers so that the barbecuers can flip tons of these at once.
Okay.
And they also barbecue up. They take a baguette and they crush the baguette and they baste it with what I'd say is honey butter and they grill it up until it gets crispy and just unbelievably delicious.
I'm getting so hungry.
They bring this to your table along with a plate of cucumbers. There's lots of cucumbers around here.
Okay.
And then somebody else appears almost instantly with a pair of big shears. And this person pulls the bamboo sticks out and cuts the chicken and bread into chunks. And of course they sell beer. I was drinking Tiger beer last night.
Fantastic. Sounds
so
good.
That was a really unique spot, like barbecue smoke everywhere.
Wow!
And the whole street, or really, it's an alley, is just barbecue chicken galore. Mm. It's nuts. Mm. I wish we had something like that back home.
Yeah, I wish that there was something like that right now in my house. I feel like eating so badly. I think I maybe should have eaten something before we called you. I feel like I'm going to be so boring compared to your exciting story. You know, of course, I'm not in Hanoi. I'm in Chicago, and I'm still working on my paper, which is not finished. I feel I have I've gone beyond the bones. I've got some flesh on there. I've got some organs. I think it's coming together. But I'll tell you, I kind of had a mental breakdown. I felt very insecure.
Oh, no.
Like I just felt like, oh my God, what am I doing here? I'm not making any kind of sense. And I just could not find, you know, I'm piecing together these ideas and I just, oh my God. And then I had to remember my tarot reading that I gave myself, ordinariness. So I went right back into ordinariness. I've been studying the concordance to Blood Meridian and looking for information there. I have been looking at page numbers, going and looking up words, seeing the context of the words, finding what page they're on, back and forth, back and forth. And I guess today I feel like I just don't care. I feel a kind of elation, like, look, what I've got is what I've got, and I feel okay about it. And I can.
You're going to be fine. You're super knowledgeable on this stuff.
I really don't know.
You know, I think you're doing the right thing. You go back to the core of what you want to get at. Try to keep it as simple as possible. And, you know, do your research. You're going to be fine.
Yeah. It's all I can do. I feel like I'm not, I thought I'm going to make a fool of myself. I'm wasting everybody's time. And then I went, well, wait a second. I heard that horn. It's okay to be in the experimental phase of presenting this. It's okay to be not sure. I just have to remember it's okay to be vulnerable. And
sure. And, you know, when you deliver the paper, it's okay to say you're in the midst of researching this.
Yeah.
As you're developing it, you're finding out more things.
That's right. Well, because I want to go to Dublin now.
Dublin? What's in Dublin?
Well, there's another conference in June.
Of course there is.
So I feel like that will be part two. You know, it's taken longer time than I thought it would be because I've got an idea. I see an image and then I realize I can't say this unless I absolutely prove it to be true. So I have to go back and look everything up two or three times because it's so easy to make an assumption and just assume, okay, that's good enough information. So I had to double check everything.
Yes, I think you have to research every which way, look at all the angles.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with some pretty detailed stuff, especially since you're talking about numbers and patterns.
Right.
And so I think it's important that you try to get it as right as you can.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
It's easy to make an assumption and then make a mistake.
Totally. Because the thing was, my heart was pattering while I was counting things. And I was like, oh my God, don't tell me. This can't be true. And then I went, you can't bring that idea to your counting. I was like a crazy person. Anyway, I do feel a little bit better. I feel like I've let go of that ego of worry and insecurity. That's the part that just can really kill you, the resistance, you know? Go ahead.
It's pretty awesome what you're doing. You know, you've got this ability to find patterns in things, which I don't have at all. I look at it and it's just, it's madness to me. It's like, how did she see this?
I think you're creating a pattern across Hanoi of the best barbecue joints.
Oh, well, I'm seeking them out. You know, I did some research to learn about the foods and stuff. So I'm, you know, I have some pretty specific ideas in mind.
Yeah.
And I'm fully enjoying.
Good. Well, the other thing I did that I think that also helped me is, you know, I like to dream, and a lot of my problem solving has literally been in the night when I'm sleeping and I wake up and I go, oh my God, like I'll have two or three numbers in my head. So when I woke up, I was solving them into a pattern. That's just weird stuff like that. Anyway, wow. I also got into a little bit about William Burroughs this week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because, you know, he is my spiritual godfather. My spiritual grandfather, if you will. And I don't know why I just started. Someone had shared, George, our friend on Facebook, George Mitalitas, had shared a great little article about five ways that William Burroughs will get rid of, destroy control systems. So one of the biggest things is you want to destroy control systems. They prevent you. And that's it. It's my control system that was preventing me from enjoying writing my paper. In a way, I'm still writing my paper, but I was stopping enjoying it because of the control system of my ego. So you want to destroy those control systems, especially in society. So I kind of enjoyed his article and I picked up a couple of things from it. He had, this was from I think it's called Ultra Culture. I want to remember to credit people that we talked about. I forgot to. I'm looking for my notes. I'm scrambling for my notes right now because Adamandia had sent us an article, and I forgot to credit the source where I got it from. So I want to do that at some point before we finish recording in the next whatever you're talking about or I'm talking about. I want to remember that by the end of it. One thing I did find that's right here in front of me was I started thinking how interesting that William Burroughs is pretty famous for his censorship trial, this court case that he had in Boston. And I started looking it up and I thought I would read a little bit of the testimony that some writers made. Allen Ginsberg testified for him and so did Norman Mailer. Norman Mailer wrote, fantastic book, Cold. In Cold Blood. So nervous talking to you and so nervous all the time when we're talking on here. I blank out.
In Cold Blood. Wasn't that Truman Capote?
Was that Truman Capote? Okay, I've blanked on it then. You're right. That was Truman Capote. Okay, so Norman Mailer. I'm not going to quote what books he wrote. Because I'm just
different ones.
I'm so
ones
nervous.
Besides that one.
That one's besides that one. Okay, so Norman Mailer. Let me see what I can find here. In Boston, Massachusetts, once the scene of such famous censorship trials as those involving former Forever Amber, God's Little Acre, and more recently, Tropic of Cancer, again attracted a distinguished gathering of literary luminaries on January 12, 1965, when a book named Naked Lunch by William Burroughs found itself the defendant in Boston Superior Court before Judge J. Hudson won. The witnesses who testified on behalf of Naked Lunch included Norman Mailer, Allen Ginsberg, John Ciardi, Paul Hollander, Gabrielle B. Jackson, Norman Holland, Stanley E. Eldred, John B. Sturrock, and Thomas H. Jackson. Now, I don't know who most of those people are, but I think they're heroes.
Well, you should start checking them out. It's a new reading list.
Right. That's true. Okay. Do you know any of them? I mean, Allen Ginsberg, obviously, and Norman.
I just the obvious ones.
Okay, good. All right. So the court. This is to Norman Mailer. The court. Have you read him before? I read a book.
You know, I read one of Norman Mailer's books a long, long time ago, and I think it had to do with Muhammad Ali, and I don't remember much about it. I found it very, very difficult to read.
Oh. You know, I think I read one on my parents' bookshelf about Marilyn Monroe.
Okay.
And hopefully I'm right, because at this point, you know, I've already screwed up with Truman Capote. So
sure, we can just decide. We can assign books.
That's right. Okay, so I thought it was kind of cool some of the things he says, though. Okay, so I read a book, Junkie, and I read it in paperback, and it's just a very good, hard-boiled sort of novel. It is a false novel. He wrote it to make some money, but it is well written. Small portions of it, as a matter of fact, appear in Naked Lunch as one of the themes. But I felt reading it through the last time, I had the feeling that the work presents a kind of complexity which I will not compare to James Joyce's Ulysses. I'd say it's not without comparison. It's possible as a work that would take considerable inquiry and study. I found it considerably less shocking as I read it this time. I felt more and more the purpose in the various parts of it. The first time through, I thought it was well written. The man has extraordinary style. He catches just a little of the beauty. I think he catches the beauty at the same time, the viciousness and the meanness of, and the excitement, you see, of ordinary talk. The talk of criminals, of soldiers, athletes, junkies. There is a kind of speech that is referred to as gutter talk that often has a very fine, incisive, dramatic line to it. And Burroughs captures that speech like no American writer I know. He also, and this makes it impressive to me as a writer, he also has an exquisite poetic sense. His poetic images are intense. They are often disgusting, but at the same time, there is a sense of collision in them, of montage that is quite unusual. And as I say, all this together gives me great respect for his style. But I also began to feel that really this time there was more to his intent than I had ever recognized before, that the work was more of a deep work, a calculated work, a planned work. In other words, the artistry in it was more deliberate and more profound than I thought before. So as a matter of fact, after this case is over, I am looking forward to finishing it. As I say, I have read just the first half this time through. Now the lawyer, DeGrazia, says, Mr. Mailer, while you were on that subject, there was a reference earlier by Mr. Cohen, Assistant Attorney General, to the question of the notes, of his notes, of which he has no precise memory of having written, which later became the basis of Naked Lunch. And I was wondering, as a writer, if you could give us your opinion, what may have been involved here? Mailer, yes, I listened to that very carefully because I remembered reading that in the beginning of the book, and it seemed to me, as I was reading the book, I started thinking about a matter that is one of the mysteries of writing. It is very often you can wake up in the morning and start writing, and you have this experience, what you are writing about is what you haven't been thinking about. It will come out in detail. One's best writing seems to bear no relation to what one is thinking about. There is an unconscious calculation that seems to go on in one's sleep. The work is done while you sleep, and the discipline of writing is almost to keep from interfering with that creative work that is done by the unconscious. In other words, isn't it? In other words, if a man is working on a novel, that his habits are regular and precise, I am getting long-winded here for a point. The best of his habits are regular because he doesn't portray the work he is performing while conscious. In Burroughs' work, I think something quite extraordinary is going on here, since the man is a self-confessed drug addict. I have heard various versions of how he wrote Naked Lunch. He seems to have been writing, he wrote somewhere, he used to write coming out of drug addictions. At other times, he says he wrote it in drug addictions while he was a drug addict. It is possible he wrote this book in all three phases. I am just guessing this. Possibly it was written while an addict, while withdrawing, and while he was withdrawn from addiction. But what is fascinating to me is that there is a structure to the book, you see, which is doubtless imperfect. I think one reason we can't call it a great book like Remembrance of Things Past or Ulysses, the imperfection of the structure. There is no doubt as to the man's talent. While it was perhaps excited and inflamed by drug addiction, it was also hurt. This man might have been one of the greatest geniuses of the English language if he had never been an addict. Through this, there is a feeling of great torture in the composition of the book. What comes through to me is that there is also style, the subconscious going through all the various trials and ordeals of addiction. He still holds on to a scheme in the book, and there is a deep meaning. It is curious the way these themes keep recurring. I have no idea how the book was put together. The ingredients are so exceptional. Like you have a banquet of 30, 40 components, you may eat in any order. You may shift them. The themes are so deeply entwined, any page put with another page creates an aura. It was so profoundly conceived. Well, it may be this book was so, as I say, has no other structure than the profundity of the experience that the author had, the particular ordeal the man went through in his life. Or it may be there is a firm structure to it. It is just on the basis of these three readings. I feel the work is sufficiently complex I couldn't begin to see. I found it absolutely fascinating because it draws me further and further, the way Ulysses did when I read that in college, as if there are mysteries to be uncovered when I read it. I just found this so interesting, and I had never read any of this before, about these people standing up for him and talking about writing. Can you imagine? Like, people don't talk about that. It took censorship to get that out there.
Well, I think that's really fascinating. You know, recently on YouTube, I watched a video of Frank Zappa testifying about censorship. And, you know, he showed up in court, you know, looking all prim and proper, and just devastated the panel. It was really, really fantastic. And, you know, our old friend Ronald Bluer testified in the Mark Prince obscenity trial.
Oh, wow.
You know, so there's quite a history of that. And, you know, when you get to the chapter in the book we've been talking about, Stranger Than We Can Imagine.
Yes.
When you get to the chapter on nihilism, he talks about junkie writers and how being a junkie was a purposeful part of a nihilist aesthetic in parts of the 20th century, which is really fascinating. I never thought about it that way.
Yeah, yeah. I'm about a chapter away from that, so I did a fair.
Oh, you're catching up to me.
I'm catching.
I'm gonna have to finish it up as bedtime reading. I planned to read it on the plane, but instead, I read the novella we talked about, the extension of our game theory episode again, yes. Chess Story by Stefan Zweig.
Oh, yeah.
Also called The Royal Game.
Yes.
Written in 1942. And wow, what a fantastic little book.
Mm. Cool. Very cool.
It's a story about events that happen on an ocean passage from Buenos Aires to Buenos Aires to somewhere. I don't remember now. The point is that it's on an ocean liner, and it's a world chess champion on the ocean liner, and it tells a story about this world chess champion who, by all accounts, is none too bright in any other area. He's an arrogant guy. He's unfriendly. And he didn't really show any talent for anything until, by watching people play chess, he not only learned how to play, he learned how to play at an extremely high level and became world champion. So the narrator of the book wants to meet him because he's fascinated by this. And so he pulls out a chessboard and he seeks challengers on this ocean liner, hoping to attract the attention of the champion, who pretty much ignores him. And he starts playing a game with this other guy who's like a financier or something like that. And he's really a bull in a china shop kind of guy. When he finds out that this chess champion is on board, he wants to play him. And he gets this idea that maybe all of the group of people who have been watching this chess match could play against this champion. So they approach the guy who wants money to play him. So he plays them and kicks their asses. And in the next game, someone appears whose name we find out is Dr. B. And Dr. B starts advising them about the game, saying, no, don't do that, do this. And it's clear that he's reading several moves ahead and he has this intense grasp of the game. And after, all the guys want this guy to play the champion the next day. And he says, no, you know, I haven't actually played a game of chess since I was a kid. And this is, it's really strange because he's obviously so good at it. Yeah. And he tells his story. And his story is that he was part of a law firm that was looking after the assets of a monastery and hiding them from the Nazis. So everything is very secret because they don't want the Nazis to get at the wealth of this monastery.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a spy in his midst, and this guy gets arrested. And instead of throwing him in a concentration camp, they basically put him in a blank room. And there's no one to talk to and nothing to look at. and he gets interrogated every day or two, and he's starting to lose his mind. The nothingness of it is killing him. And somehow or other, they take him to some place where he's waiting for interrogation, and he sees a book about chess master games in somebody's pocket, and he manages to filch the book. And when he's back in his cell, he starts looking at the book, and he's really disappointed because it's all, the games are laid out in symbols. Right. And he has to figure out what the symbols mean. And since he doesn't have a chessboard, he sort of fashions some semblance of a chessboard and then eventually learns to do it in his mind. So he plays through all of these games in his mind over and over again until he learns them by heart. And then he gets this idea that he started to go crazy again. He starts to challenge himself to chess games. And in order to do that, it's very difficult because, of course, you know what you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But he tries to create two separate selves that can play against one another. And over and over again, he plays these games. So without ever playing an actual game of chess, he studies chess while in confinement. And when he's released and he sees this chess game going on, he has to get involved, you know?
Right.
And that's really the core of the story. It's a fascinating and somewhat terrifying story about what can happen to your mind in confinement and how sometimes the deprivation of anything of interest can be worse than the worst concentration camp for your mind, you know? This guy finds the one thing that he can hold on to in order to try to keep his sanity. Fantastic book. I highly recommend it. It's a novella. It's short. Well worth reading.
Okay. Very good. Post a picture of it or something on Facebook. I have not been on Facebook in the last 24 hours very often, so I'm assuming you've posted a lot of pictures. I've got to do some catching up.
Yes, I have, and I did one Facebook Live video yesterday.
Cool.
I'm just wandering through a really busy part of the old quarter, and at one point, I don't know why, this one corner was so busy, so congested, I couldn't even get through between the cars and the motorbikes and the tourists. This one area north of the Hoang Kim Lake, near a place called Beer Corner, where it's like the tourist capital of the universe. There's people from all over the world who come and drink inexpensive beer, eat snacks, and get to know each other. It's like a backpacker heaven there. And that's sort of where the most number of tourists are around here. And as you get further away, there's less and less tourists. Still a lot all through the old quarter. And then once you leave the old quarter, like when I walked out to the Chicken Street last evening, during the walk, all I saw were Vietnamese folks. And then once I got to Chicken Street, there was mostly Vietnamese people and one group of Australians.
Hmm.
Lots of Australian visitors to this town.
Hmm. Pretty cool. So you've seen a lot of different types of people and a lot of tourists. Yeah, I've heard that it's just like the tourists. It's fantastic for traveling. And people love the food. Yeah.
Oh, the food is so good. Yesterday, for breakfast, near the hotel, there's a set of alleys, which is just street food heaven. They're just filled with street food stalls. And I found a place to get something called pho quan, which is, pho is noodles. And it's like a rolled out flat noodle stuffed with beef and greens and rolled up. And they give you a dipping sauce, which is like a fish sauce with garlic and chunks of, I don't know if it was green mango or green papaya.
Okay.
And you dip these rolls that are about 6 inches long.
Okay.
You pick them up with your chopsticks and you dip them in this dipping sauce. And you also drizzle hot sauce on them, of course, because there's hot sauce everywhere.
Everywhere.
And they're so yummy. That was breakfast yesterday. And for lunch, I went for my first bowl of pho here in Hanoi to a place called Pho Tin, Thin. It's a well-known place. It's a little hole in the wall. I thought it was like a self-contained little hole in the wall restaurant. But in fact, it was an alley that went somewhere. And I didn't realize that until a motorcycle drove past me. Motorbikes they go everywhere in this town. It's motorbike heaven. it's pho pho, and that's beef noodle soup.
Okay.
And you don't have to order. You sit down and they bring you your soup. Because that's all they have on the menu with, I guess, one addition. You can get something called quay, which looks like a long donut. It's like a deep fried dough, crispy deep fried dough.
Okay.
It can't be healthy for you. But what you do is you dunk it in your soup the way in North America we might dunk crackers in our soup.
Okay.
Okay, and super delicious dunked in the soup. It's a really lovely broth, loads of noodles, and as condiments, they have, this place has a homemade hot sauce that you spoon in, and they have garlic and vinegar. So you spoon on some chunks of vinegar garlic onto your soup. Yum. Oh, it's so good. Mm. And the soup is filled with herbs and scallions. Just super delicious. It was really a lovely bowl for a rainy late morning.
You tasting food that you cannot get in Toronto?
You can get a lot of Vietnamese food in Toronto, but it's mostly South Vietnamese food.
Okay.
So
you are trying something, you are able to try something different there.
Oh, yeah.
Completely different flavors.
Even your basic beef soup is quite different in Toronto than here. The northern pho has, it has thicker noodles. It has, let's call it a cleaner broth. In the south of Vietnam, it's much more fragrant. They use star anise and cinnamon in the broth.
Okay.
And it's much more of a cleaner beef broth here. So it's a little bit different. Oh, and I also had yesterday.
Or was I'm laughing at the weird vehicles that drive by every now and then.
Oh, it's crazy.
Okay, I lost you there. I lost your voice.
I also had a Hanoi specialty. Okay, am I back?
Yep.
Am I back now?
Yes.
Okay. I had a Hanoi specialty. I don't even remember when it was. I'm unstuck in time, like Vonnegut's Billy Pilgrim. I have no idea what day it is anymore.
So it goes.
So it goes. I had something called bun cha. And bun is vermicelli noodles.
Mm.
And cha is meat. In this case, it's pork done two ways. It's grilled pork belly, and it's pork patties grilled. And the whole dish comes deconstructed. So you get a bowl of this pork in a slightly sweet sauce, and then you get a plate of noodles, and you get a ridiculously big heaping plate of greens, lettuce, and herbs, all kinds of different herbs. And you reconstruct the food by dropping it into the sauce and then eating it from the sauce. Super, super delicious. And you get it with typically with spring rolls, which they call nem. And you also dip the nem in the sauce. It's super good. It's one of the best foods you can ever imagine. I could probably eat bun cha every day.
Wow.
No problem.
How's your writing going while you're there? Are you taking a lot of notes?
Yes, I've been writing every day. I have a notebook, and I'm writing about all my walks. And you know, once I get home, I'll go through it and probably rewrite everything and kind of jazz it up.
Yeah. Cool. Very cool.
So I'm sort of doing it like a diary.
Yeah.
And I've been blogging as well. So
yeah.
For our listeners, if you want to read about adventures in Hanoi, go to 27thstreet.me. That's 27thstreet.me. And I'm doing blog posts every day. In fact, I did one this morning.
Excellent.
About this morning's breakfast. So so I'll be regularly reporting in, and I'm going to continue to do some Facebook Live. If the rain lets up, it's kind of misting out again. If it lets up, I'll do a Facebook Live maybe at the Temple of Literature.
That'd be great. That'd be great. And, you know, you've posted lots of photos too, which is fantastic, of the food you're eating too.
Yes, also on Instagram. So you can check out my Instagram account.
Very cool. Very cool.
This morning, I had a coffee after my breakfast at a little cafe. I was up very early. It was like maybe 7 in the morning, and the town was just waking up. So about half of the food joints were open and half were still closed. Mm. And a lot of the coffee shops, particularly the chain coffee places, weren't open yet. And right. when I say chain, I don't mean $5. I haven't seen a $5 there. But they have Kong Cafe, which is decked out to look like communist army getup.
Right.
The whole, that's the decor. And there's a few different cafes that are chains and all kinds of sort of mom and pop places. And almost all of them have little tables and chairs facing the street. And, you know, watching the street is a major pastime here.
Mm. Very, I bet
also,
it is.
Also, yesterday I stopped at a Bia Hoy place. And okay. if you want to open a bar in this town, all you need is a sidewalk, a tarp to use as an awning, and a keg of beer.
I do glasses. Want to open up a bar there. That's exactly what I want to do.
this place had snacks as well, but the big thing was beer. And I think I paid $1.50 for two pints of draft.
That's awesome. That's super awesome.
It's a light, sort of a light Pilsner draft, really yummy, really good. And at this place, it was mostly Vietnamese folks gathered around having snacks and beers.
Nice.
There's these all over every, like almost every block has one of these places. But there's cafes, food joints, and Bia Hoy joints absolutely everywhere.
Very cool.
Although this morning in my walk, I walked onto some street and there were some buildings, maybe they were government buildings or something, I don't know. But there were people dressed up in what looked like army uniforms, and they were holding machine guns. So I turned around. I decided whatever was going on this street was none of my business.
Okay.
I didn't want any part of that action.
All right.
I wanted to take a picture, but then I thought that's probably a really, really bad idea.
Right.
So I didn't do that. I just turned around and hightailed it out of there and went to a friendlier street.
Okay.
Also, a lot of the streets in the old quarter, originally, every street was like a craft guild. So each street, there was like a silk street, a bamboo street. So there's streets that are named after what was originally on the street. And some of that still carries forward today. Some of it less so, but there's lots of that stuff. And everywhere there's these stores that are called things like Made in Vietnam. And they sell stuff that was probably made in China.
Right.
But they're like North Face knockoffs, that kind of thing.
Yep.
The uniform around here, like a lot of the men pull up on their motorbike with their North Face knockoff jackets. That's a real big thing here.
Right. Oh. Okay, I want to do my fix it.
Well, you do your fix it. I'm going to see if I can order up another mango smoothie.
All right, sounds good. Okay, so the fix it is, we did get a DM from Adamandia last week, and it was from War History Online. She'd sent us the article War History Online by George Winston, and that is where he talks about the radiation from the Marshall Islands being so much worse than Chernobyl.
Yes.
And then we got an email. We got an email this week, and it's from Vox, and I'll just quickly read it. Hello, okay. Agents. I almost sent you this link last week after the stuff on Chernobyl, but thought better of it. But as you have continued with the subject, I figured, what the hey, why not? Do not miss reading the comments section, for they are probably more sensible than the actual article. By the way, I have also seen film from many of the A-bomb explosions, and they are both visually stunning and extremely horrifying all at once. Best wishes, Rick. So that felt good because it was nice to know that I wasn't alone in enjoying, in some bizarre way, those A-bomb films.
Yes.
Yeah. They are visually stunning. And
yes, of course.
Yeah. The article he sent also talked about the Marshall Islands and that there was a dome built over some of the toxic waste.
Wow.
So I will link both of those articles for anyone who wants to look at them on our Facebook page. And I found the dome totally fascinating as well. It is also beginning to crack and has problems. It's something like 18 inches thick of concrete. And, you know, on a beautiful, beautiful island in in the ocean. What? And, you know, a terrible thing.
So, I wonder if that's the source of what's that movie? Maybe there's multiple movies where people live inside like a dome where it's a wasteland outside and you can't leave. I don't know. I think there's various science fiction type movies that are like that, and they must have at their core those radiation disasters, much like the Japanese Godzilla films.
Exactly. And you said at their core, ha ha ha. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's very funny. Unintentionally funny.
Unintentionally funny. Oh, we also got a little quick, basically a sculpture recommendation from Bob. So he says, Eugene and Candy, have you come across Oliver Eliasson? There is a pronunciation challenge for you. I hope I got it. I am wondering if this 3 to 4 dimensions, if you include light as a dimension, type of art is going to speak to humans more in the future, as our environment gets more and more overstimulated with virtual inputs in our eye experience of looking at two-dimensional screens. Love your show, Bob. And so I will link the sculpture is really quite beautiful. I don't know if you got a chance to look at that, Eugene.
Yes, I did have a chance to look before I left.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of interesting. I'd like to see it in person. Definitely looks like some of it was very, very beautiful. It looked like lightingscapes and some sculpture mixed with lighting. It looked very beautiful.
I don't know if you can hear the sound, but...
We're going to call this episode... Oh, I've got a title for this episode already. Hanoi okay. Noise.
Excellent. Well, right now you're listening to my mango smoothie number 2 being made.
Okay. All right.
I figure we can do the whole episode from here. It's pretty relaxed. It's quiet in this cafe. I just ordered a second smoothie.
Great. I bet it's delicious.
Oh, it's totally yummy. Around here, it's coffee and smoothie culture in this town.
That's kind of cool.
Smoothies and beer.
And do you just see people sitting around in cafes?
Oh, yeah, everywhere. It's a totally popular thing to do, sitting around, particularly looking out at the roads and the action in the street, hanging out and drinking coffee. Totally coffee culture, way more than in Toronto, for instance.
Yeah, maybe more than Chicago, right? And it's what's, you know what that's reminding me of?
Well, there are a lot of chains. I was in one cafe yesterday that had a tree growing through the cafe. You know, really funky places.
Yeah. Well, a lot of places where imagination can blossom from the pictures you sent me on WhatsApp. Listen, it kind of reminds me, he talks a little bit about the cafe culture in our 20th century book by Higgs. Stranger Than We Can Know. And it sort of seems like it's such a great way for the imagination and culture to develop is sitting around in public spaces like cafes. It's something
I think.
Yeah. If you do it here, sometimes I feel like our cafes have gotten a little too secluded. Whereas in New York City, there's still like there's some cafes that you just feel like you're half in the street, which I think is a really good way for a cafe to be.
Well, the cafe I'm in now, I'm actually, I don't know how to explain this. It's like the cafe opens up to the outside, but it's like 2 steps up from the street. And just to the left of me, a step down, there's a long bench with some little tables that face the street. So I'm actually elevated from the sidewalk about 2 feet. There's a cement floor and the cafe is here. I don't know if how they close it up. Yeah, there's a sliding door that closes over everything.
Right.
And they just bring in the tables. But a lot of things go out on the cafe. Where's room, of course, because in this town, sidewalks are not for walking. They're for parking your motorbike. And when you go walking on the streets, a lot of times you have to actually walk on the road. Because the sidewalks are so clogged with motorbikes. There's motorbikes everywhere. I've never seen so many motorbikes.
Wow.
And crossing the street is, I'm getting used to it now. And the basic thing is you try to avoid crossing when there's cars. And if there's, 20 motorbikes coming at you, you don't worry about them. You just step out on the street like you mean it, with all these motorbikes converging on you, and they swarm around you like a school of fish. It's really crazy, but yeah. I'm no longer afraid of motorbikes bearing down on me.
Well,
because
good.
They just, you know,
I think,
yeah, you mean you have to be watchful. You have to especially be watchful of turning motorbikes, because you want to make sure you see who's coming, and you want to make sure you look at them, they look at you, you walk in one direction, you don't hesitate, because they're as they're driving, calculating where you're going, so they
right.
don't hit you, right?
Right, right, exactly.
And so you just go, and everybody just goes.
Well, it's, there's some. It's there's some.
sorry, go ahead.
I wasn't sure where we're going here. There's some work done that areas with less traffic laws are safer because people are working harder to stay safe.
I have no doubt. Here, everybody honks their horn. But in Toronto, if someone honks their horn, it's because they are pissed off.
Right.
Here, they honk their horn to say, I'm going here. Nobody's pissed off.
Okay.
Nobody gets pissed off
yeah.
on the road.
Well, that's it. That's funny. It's part of the conversation.
Oh, yeah. And the traffic is insane. Sometimes the roads are super, super busy. And as I say, motorbikes all over the place. I'm just seeing a motorbike driving on the sidewalk here beside me. and like traffic laws, if it's a one-way street, that means maybe 80% of traffic is going the correct way.
Right, right.
Right? Doesn't mean that everyone's going the correct way.
Right.
And there are stoplights on some intersections, and that means that some of the traffic might stop. But don't expect turning traffic to ever stop.
Right.
Right? So you just assume nobody's stopping, and you avoid the cars, because the cars might not stop, but the motorbikes, you can be pretty confident that the motorbikes are going to avoid you.
Yeah. Cool. Very good. All right.
Oh, the smoothie is so good.
I've got my Irish breakfast tea. I will be... Is that you... Is that you drinking the straw? Is that the sound of you straw?
No, that's street sound.
Was that another street sound? I feel like you're in another planet, you know?
Yes.
The sounds are very strange.
There's a little chihuahua walking by with a jacket on.
Oh, how cute.
This morning I stopped at a cafe for some rocket fuel, and I sat down at a little table, and there's a rooster walking around the tables. He's walking around and
fantastic.
He starts crowing in the morning.
Fantastic.
And it's really the most fantastic thing.
Yeah, that's cool.
The chihuahua has an owner who's walking more or less with it.
Well, we have something in common. There's a lot of chihuahuas and roosters around where I am right now. It's not it's not unusual for me to see a rooster sitting outside our house.
Oh yeah?
Yep. A lot of people have them. As cute little pets around here. I hope they're pets. I hope they're pets.
The lady who owns the chihuahua just said sing chow, which is hi, and waved at me.
Oh, good.
Yeah, people are super friendly.
Well, they're probably fascinated by a man sitting with a microphone and headphones on.
Yeah. In some areas, people have lots of English. In other areas, less so.
Okay.
Like when I went to Chicken Street last night, English was scant. But they bring out a menu which has photos of wings and photos of chicken legs and everything, photos of the bread, and you point to what you want. And you know, typically everyone understands beer because beer is bia.
Okay.
So if you order beer, they hear bia. You order bia, it's beer. It's the same thing, right?
Cool.
So it's easy to order beer. When I wanted more wings, because I ordered up some to try, and then it was so good, I had to order more wings. So I got the attention of a server, and I sort of pointed and said, one more serving. Or actually, I wanted two more. They're big wings, so two more. And to confirm that I wanted wings, she flapped her arms, sort of like a bird.
Okay.
Right. So
there
it's like
go.
I didn't want the leg. I wanted the I wanted the wings.
Whatever it takes. Yes.
The other thing I've noticed around here is it's like it's an old town. It's a 1,000-year-old city, right?
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the buildings are old, and you know, some of them seem to be built in a really ramshackle kind of way. But at the same time, it's a very clean town. In the evening and in the morning, there's people out sweeping the streets all the time, cleaning up garbage, sweeping up. Cigarette butts. There's a load of smokers in this town.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like New Orleans.
Yeah. I mean, it's something else. And
are you on the ocean? I have no idea where Hanoi is. Is it on the ocean or is it interior?
No, it's not. It's inland. It's on the Red River.
Okay.
So there's a big river that flows through it. Later in the week, I'm gonna go over to the Longbian Bridge. It's like a kilometer-long bridge that was built around 1900. And I'm going to walk the bridge and take some photos there.
Great. I'm going to look at Hanoi on a map later.
That bridge is right now, you can only either walk it or the train goes across it or motorbikes. No cars on that bridge. And it was bombed during the French War and the American War and then fixed up. Mm. So I think they're fixing up the bridge again. It's constantly being fixed up. So I'm looking forward to that walk. I'm trying to do different walks every day, going to different places, different directions, seeing different parts of the city.
So great. So great.
And I think also later in the week, I'm going to go up near West Lake, which is about a 30-minute walk north of here. There's a place called the Hanoi Cooking Center, and I'm going to sign up for a cooking class or two.
Oh, my God, that's awesome.
Yes, they have cooking classes. We'll be able to do a cooking class kind of podcast too, probably.
Totally. You should give me a shopping list and I'll, try and make something too.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah.
They started the cooking classes by taking you to the market.
Oh.
And they shop for all the things that you're going to cook with.
Isn't that great?
It's very, very cool. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that.
That's so cool.
The local transportation here is Grab. There's taxis, but there's lots of taxi scams. You know, taxis with fast meters and that. But then Grab came in, and then Uber, which Grab and Uber are very similar. And then I think Grab bought out Uber. But you have the app, and you can order up a Grab bike. So guy comes on his motorbike. You put in your destination, and you know the price. It tells you the price when you put in your destination. Buddy shows up, hands you a helmet, you hop on the back of the motorbike, and he takes you to wherever you want to go for a couple bucks.
So great.
It's pretty fantastic idea. I've been walking primarily, but there's going to be some places in which I'll take a Grab to, for sure.
Fantastic. All right. Now, I also found another little bit I want to say about William Burroughs. So if someone here has not read, that noise is crazy. So his most famous novel, obviously, is Junkie and Naked Lunch, but those are not my favorite novels. They're great, but my very, very favorite novels, which I think are incredible, are The Place of Dead Roads, Cities of the Red Night, and The Western Lands. And they function as a trilogy, and they are amazing, okay? And they're all kind of...
I haven't read them.
Yeah, they're so good. Eugene, you've got to read at least one of them one time. They're kind of... cowboys, Wild West, and gay, and adventure. Oh, yeah, and time travel. They're amazing.
Fabulous.
And I read them before Blood Meridian. I probably sounds like Cormac McCarthy is my favorite writer, but I would say, nothing on William Burroughs. Nothing. So it's just that I don't have a connection with a bunch of people doing papers on William Burroughs. Maybe next I will. Maybe I'll do that trilogy sometime. So as I was saying at the beginning, I got into him because I was reading this article and I thought it would help me kind of loosen up my imagination, because you want to smash reality. That's the whole point, is you want to smash reality because that's holding us back. One thing that William Burroughs is so influential that we're still feeling it way, way before Michael Pollan wrote How to Change Your Mind about the medicine of ayahuasca or DMT, the toad medicine. Or ecstasy, William Burroughs took ayahuasca to heal himself from alcoholism, from heroin, to kick heroin. I mean, he's so ahead of his time. It's insane. Maybe he had heard about the Canadians that were healing alcoholism with LSD. So maybe there was something in that, but he did go to South America. I remember our book, One River, that we both read. The main character in that, Schultes, he was not a fan of William Burroughs, but William Burroughs was out there kind of educating the masses about altered realities for sure. So he has seven ways that you can get rid of, you can smash reality. And one of them is cut-ups. What he and Brian Gayson did, they took text, you chop it up and you put it together and write poetry with lines and words.
Sure.
And people do that. It turned into that magnet thing on fridges. Remember where people have words on their fridge?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
And he also...
Naturally, eventually it gets commercialized and completely fed back to us.
Completely. And you know that kind of feeling of cool? He had something called do easy. He believed in doing everything the easiest possible way. And I live by that. I think it's a great way to do things. There's things.
I agree. I like to be intelligently lazy.
Yeah, me too. Exactly. And of course he did dream control, where he would write down, he did a diary. I don't do a diary of dreams. I just, if they come to me in the morning, I just think about them when I wake up. And he also has a little thing here. I'm just looking for it, for total focus on destabilizing control. He's got five things here. Proclaim a new era and set up a new calendar. Replace alien language. Destroy or neutralize alien gods. Destroy alien machinery of government control. Take wealth and land from individual aliens. And that kind of ties into the book we were reading too about the 20th century, because the author is trying to tell us that the Russian monarchy and monarchies around the world, except for England, crumbled because people didn't want that control system running things. It left it wide open for the war between capitalism and communism, of course. But I wonder now, if people are so afraid of anarchy and they're so afraid of change, I wonder if we're not seeing that the way that the monarchy could fall is the way capitalism could fall. You know, I don't know if it's going to fall completely or if it's going, but the anti-capitalist movement sort of seems related to that whole thing that was happening with the Russians and the Russian monarchy and the French monarchy that was being broken down in the early 20th century.
This reminds me, Candy, speaking of monarchy, on the way here, I read that the pop singer Madonna had suggested to Harry and Meghan that they forget Canada and move to New York and sublet her apartment.
Well, she's got to have a hard time subletting that apartment. Who can afford her, right?
Yes, I guess you have a small group that can afford her level of luxury.
Right.
I don't know how she lives, but I assume it's a level of luxury.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
I think that in the Higgs book, he talks about how the beat writers embraced Burroughs, but he was kind of separate from them.
Yes.
He separated himself from them, and like everything else, he wasn't going to be a part.
Right. Yep.
Pretty interesting.
It is pretty interesting. He did. I think that was also to protect his own, you know, his own imagination and his own work. So sometimes you have to be part of a group, but then you also have to go and be alone.
Yes. Sometimes being part of a group allows you exposure.
True. And sometimes, you've got to go back into your cave and the drawing board, you know?
But then it also hems you in.
Yes.
Like, you know, when Philip Guston was an abstract expressionist, he reached a point where he couldn't do that work anymore. And when he started to do those incredibly compelling, weird, terrifying later works and showed them in New York City, almost all of the abstract expressionists condemned the work.
You know,
said, what is this guy doing?
Right.
With the exception of Willem de Kooning, who said, I don't see what the problem is. This is all about freedom.
Yes, exactly. And I think you forget, you get addicted to your techniques. You know, and if you want to shake loose those things and shake those boundaries off or try something.
Yes, and the power of a group on your freedom, on your creative abilities is huge. Because as soon as you start challenging the ideas of the others, you can be ostracized, right?
Right.
Well, you know, in a case like Guston, I mean, he powered past all these people with this incredible burst of creative, crazy creative energy. Whereas they were doing the same kinds of paintings, which, well, interesting, that movement was waning, you know?
And they were dying too.
in a lot of cases.
Yeah. It's kind of an occupational hazard. As
do you know that Guston and Jackson Pollock were expelled from high school together?
No, that's really funny.
Yeah, I don't know what they did, but they were both expelled from
high school. And they were friends in high school?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and then
that's actually mind-blowing.
They became, and particularly Guston, became a WPA mural painter doing social realist-type paintings.
Yes.
And in a way, his late work harkened back to that.
Yes.
You know, some of the same themes came up, but came up in a much more chilling way. Yeah. But if you look in the early Guston works, there's a painting called If This Not Be I, you know, which reminds me of what he did later on when he painted self-portraits with a Klan hood staring at a bottle.
You know? Right.
I mean, just absolutely chilling paintings. And you know, I read an interview with him where he said, I wanted to know what it felt like to be evil, riding around at night, staring at light bulbs.
Yeah.
Just gives me the chills thinking about it. And somebody said to him, you know, these are so hard to look at. And his response was, yeah, well, imagine having to live with them.
Yeah. I think it's funny because, you know, a group dynamic or a philosophy can hold you back. And maybe that's why he had to separate himself. And you don't want the beat philosophy to hold you back. If it's not freedom giving, then it's a problem. So if you feel like you know, you don't have something in common with people, sometimes you do have to step away. But I also think that if you teach them, harken back to a topic. I know, I love it. Go back to it. In the same way that Vox was writing us, and he thought since we'd already talked about Chernobyl and radiation, that he wouldn't send us that article. We are circling back on many topics, and we're not following a rule. I don't feel any rule that, we've talked about William Burroughs. We can't talk about it again. Oh, we've talked about Philip Guston. We can't talk about him again. I think it's okay for these things to resurface. We're not sure.
Of course.
So anyone out there that's thinking that they might have wished they had responded to an earlier podcast or they're not keeping up, there's no keeping up. We're in a circular rolling discussion here. And
well, exactly.
You know, and we don't know where it's going either.
Exactly. For anyone who hasn't figured it out, we're making this up as we go along.
And we want to hear from you on any topic that we're talking about. If it's food, if it's radiation, if it's an old movie, a new movie. Send us a recommendation. If you had a thought during the podcast, just tell us what you're thinking and feeling. We'd really like to know. It doesn't have to be so-called important or so-called topical. We're going to return to topics over and over again.
Yes, and you can email us at theagency.podcast@gmail.com. And we love emails.
We love it. We love it.
Also, we want to thank our supporters.
Sorry,
you're fantastic listeners. We love you.
Yep, we love you, and you faded out there. So Eugene had just thanked our patrons on Patreon. We really appreciate it. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Mike. Oh, we lost I think we're losing our internet connection.
Oh, it could be. It could be. Okay. I don't know how long my charge is going to last. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can still hear you.
Maybe this means that it's almost time to
I think so.
Why don't you finish with the thank yous and we'll wrap up.
All right. So thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Michelle and Mike. And we realize we have some real noise challenges in this episode. I think we're going to keep it anyway. Eugene sounds like he's underwater, but he said so many interesting things. I think we're going to just go with it anyway. Eugene, I hope you enjoy that university today or that visit to the Temple of Literature.
Yes. And also a thank you to the folks at the Aha Cafe who've been providing me with smoothies here.
Great. All right. We'll talk to you in a couple days because we're going to record a couple more times.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.